across the galaxy. This is where conspiracy on the wild side meets the perspective of a lifetime. This is the Free Zone with your host, Freeman.
Hello and welcome to the Free Zone. As many of you know, this show has been a quest in understanding the occult connected to the military-industrial complex. It has been an adventure to understand the correlations between the practices of magic and our modern technologies. Yes, the radio, the television, even the modern-day computer all have their roots in shadowy societies that are seeking communication with the other side. And to this end, I have invited Peter Moon, the synchronistic chronicler of the Montauk story. Peter was led into a mystery that seemed to be encoded in his own personal DNA and has now penned numerous books on the Montauk Project. Too many to list here. We have Montauk, The Alien Connection, The Black Sun, Pyramids of Montauk. You can find all of these at skybooks.com. So I would like to welcome to the show a wonderful investigator, Peter Moon.
Oh, thank you very much. I just want to make a correction. It's skybooksusa.com is the website. Skybooksusa.com.
Skybooksusa.com. All right. And we will have that link there so that everyone could go check out these many books, because I have found so many tidbits of amazing information in your books, Peter, and it is just quite a wild ride. And I wonder if we could begin just at Montauk and the occult history of the Montauk Indians. I think one of the things that really struck home with me, that stuck in my mind after the many years of reading Pyramids of Montauk, was the idea of Thomas Jefferson going off to Montauk, New York, to meet with the Montauk Indians and gather the only known dictionary of their language, which was subsequently lost on his return trip home. But we find that this Montauk language seems to have Hebrew roots. So let's talk about many of the strange legends about the area of Montauk, or what is known as Camp Hero, and some of these odd ancient occult connections and even Egyptian connections to the Montauk Indians.
Well, yes, of course, the Montauk Project is the time travel and mind control experiments that were occurring primarily during the 70s at Montauk Point, New York, which is at the extreme eastern end of Long Island. And as I began to investigate the veracity of the stories, because I was not involved in the experiment, this was the work of Preston Nichols, which I helped him codify in a book, The Montauk Project Experiments in Time. But as not only as an independent, but with him, I attempted to investigate the what this was, and I came upon a long string of synchronicities, which were in a book, Montauk Revisited. And at the end of that book, I didn't put it in the book because they all led me to this book by a man named Rufus Wilson, The History of Long Island, which showed that there were pyramids on Long Island, the pyramids of Montauk. It's Montauk, the pyramids, Montauk, no explanation of them. So I ended up in a back room, archival room with the librarian, and found out that the Montauk Indians were known as the Pharaohs, the royal tribe of Long Island. The royal family were the Pharaohs, a name that has been transliterated into Fowler. So you'll find many Montauk Indians are Fowler. They're known as Fowler because that's the way the Dutch would call them. And they were, they had a, well, the history on them was a huge book. I bought the book for $80. It had a whole history by a woman named Gaynell Stone, had done this history of the Montauk Indians. There was no mention of pyramids. But the long and short of it was I became friendly with a man named William Cooper, who was the a tribal leader or tribal chief. He had assumed the mantle of the tribal leader because there was no tribal leader as such. That position was later disputed. But he introduced me to the shaman of the Montauk Indians, Sharon Jackson, also known as Winona Redbird. And she befriended me. She immediately saw what I was doing and trying to do, but she brought me to a Thanksgiving Day celebration in 1993. And it's interesting because I spoke to one Native American who was insulted at the idea of Thanksgiving, but these Montauk Natives, or Indians as they're called, and they don't resist the name Indian, they celebrate Thanksgiving as their own heritage. But so I was at this, and I brought up the subject of the pyramids and the pharaohs. Of course, they knew about the pharaohs. And I met a woman there, Gail Evening Star, who remembered the pyramids. She remembered that there were pyramids, and nobody ever believed her, but she remembered them through her grandfather, who used to do ceremony in these pyramids. The best I can figure, because there were different stories, is that they were pretty much destroyed in the hurricane of 1938. There was a big hurricane out there, and they either had, they might have been located off the point of Long Island, which is a, Long Island has been losing its seashore. I mean, the Montauk Point has been slowly losing its seashore for hundreds of years, and they have a lighthouse at the end with a big underground area under it, and or adjacent to it, and they shore it up with rocks to protect it. There was once a big, huge, I call it, it looked like a mining shaft that they could take a tank underneath there. That was huge, that is now covered up with rocks if you go and see it on the south shore of the lighthouse. Now, so Gail remembered it, and we were very happy to validate what we both kind of saw. She told me the historical story, anecdote, and I had the pictures to show it, which I put in the third book in the series, Pyramids of Montauk, which was an attempt to explain these. Now, Sharon Jackson told me that their tribe had Egyptian roots. They had Egyptian roots that went back to Egypt, and that the tribe was from Egypt. They came over here on ships. This is not such a startling idea anymore. I've traced this back. There's an excellent book, and I can't remember the name of the book, but I know the author was Arthur Wilson, and it's about the Prince Modoc, who he says he did a lot of historical research. He's an English author, and Prince Modoc, there's the Modoc Indians, or Modoc, however you say it, and the Mantan Indians that came up Alabama. Come up from Alabama and settled all the way into Montana. That's how we get Montana, and moved to the West Coast where there was also the Modoc Indians off of Shasta. They were the last tribe to surrender in California. And Prince Modoc was, according to this man, was the brother of King Arthur. And there are a lot of place names in Kentucky and that general area of King Arthur and Prince Modoc. The actual King Arthur is said to have come to the area of Kentucky, which is a whole sacred area in and of itself. And there is some author, and I can't remember who it is, who did a lot of scrounging around the area of Kentucky. It might have been Peter Lavenda, I'm not sure, but it was somebody who studied and did a lot of investigating in that area. And yes, there are a lot of place names of Kentucky. That's a separate subject. Which a name that transliterates into Kentucky, Kentucky, Kentucky. And I once recognized this in a Japanese cartoon where they were calling the Kentucky, the Kentucky. The Kentucky was a designation for somebody like royalty, like a prince or something. The Kentucky, they called him. It's just like Kentucky or Kentucky. But it sounded almost like Kentucky the way they were phonetically saying it in the English translated of the Japanese cartoon. So the Prince Modoc came up, and I believe, now this is all based upon putting fragments of oral tradition. I eventually met the Montauk medicine man, Red Medicine, or Artie Crippen would be his Christian style name. And he told me about that they were settled by a man, the Montauk Indians, they kind of were intermixed with whatever here were indigenous, came over by way of Egypt, a man named Montauk Pharaoh. His name was Mantak Pharaoh, Montauk Pharaoh. And Montauk Pharaoh came here, and there were Welsh people The Montauk people had Welsh people, he told me. So I put all this together, and being that Prince Modoc is and King Arthur are considered to be from Wales or they're Welsh, you have a – and Wales was also known as It's like a name like Cumran. If you see how the Welsh pronounce their own place, I can't even remember it now. It's like Cumra. Cumra. It's like Cumran. It was known as the Egypt of the North. Wales was. The Wales in the UK. So it's like you get this Cumra, Cumran, which is very much like the name Cameron, which appears in the Montauk story. The name Cameron, Duncan Cameron, is the main psychic involved. So you have this connection to Wales, which comes over, and you have different phonetic transliterations of names. So as I studied this quite deeply, and I put it in the book, The Montauk Book of the Living, it became just kind of an aha moment when I saw Montauk Pharaoh is very much like the word Madoc, Montauk. You change the D to a T, and you take away the N, which the N is often turned into an apostrophe in some languages. You get Madoc, Montauk. Madoc. So it seemed to me that they were the one and the same person, because we do know that Prince Madoc came up into Mobile, Alabama, and into up the river and all the way across into the western United States. How far he actually made it, I don't know. There's also a case to be made for King Arthur, and that there being a cataclysm that started the Dark Ages, which wasn't just the rats in Rome. When they killed the cats, they had a plague because the rats didn't get killed because they were killing all the cats. And then you had the bubonic plague and whatnot. But there was also a dark comet or something of the light that hit and caused the Dark Ages. I believe that's the scholarship of Arthur Wilson. And you had a Dark Ages, so they came in Europe, they came over here. And all of this becomes very fascinating when we consider the legends of the indigenous people of what we now call Mexico, because they believed in the god Quetzalcoatl. And Quetzalcoatl had a brother who was sometimes characterized as evil, who was known as Smoking Mirror. And Smoking Mirror, he either had an obsidian disc for a face or he had it on his foot. So when he looked down into his foot, he saw an obsidian disc. And this obsidian disc this legend is symbolic of the story of John Dee, the famous necromancer and magician of the Queen Elizabeth I, Queen of England. And John Dee was the master intelligence officer, master occultist, master manipulator of that regime, known with the codename 007.
He really is the whole reason Queen Elizabeth even made a trek to America.
I've not heard of her coming to America.
No. Sending the people to America was John Dee's impetus, telling the Queen as her counselor that there was magic to be found, and gold, of course.
Yes,
to the West. So it was John Dee that really started this entire movement to America by the Britons.
Well, yes, and he coined the word Rule Britannia, which started the whole English Navy, you know, with the defeat of the Spanish Armada, and we give a story of that, a historical analogy in that, in the story of The Tempest by William Shakespeare, is, you know, creating a tempest to blow away the Spanish Armada. So this begins the England's rulership of the seas, and the phrase Rule Britannia. And the Virginia Company was some have studied that's the corporation that indeed runs America. And, of course, the onset of the British East India Company and the West India Company, the Dutch, and all these people are involved in growing heroin and tea, and, you know, selling the heroin to buy tea, and it created a lot of problems with the Chinese, of course. And so they started a pattern of world domination, the English did, under the tutelage and sorcery of John Dee. But to get back to John Dee, he had either created or relayed a legend that his shoe stone, his black obsidian mirror that he had, where he did all this necromancy with, and formulated with the help of the angels, or should say transcribed the Enochian language, the magical language of Enoch. This shoestone, he claimed that he got it from his ancestor, Prince Madoc. So if this is true, I think he said they went back to the 1300s, but this, according to Arthur Wilson, this Prince Madoc goes back into 300 or 400. King Arthur is that long ago. So in any case, there is a consistency with this sort of phonetic name coming over with this shoestone, and it ties the Montauk Pharaoh into perhaps he is related to what the Mexicans identified as Quetzalcoatl, or was thrown into the mix, and the shoestone comes back to England. Now, there's also an inconsistency of dates. Arthur Wilson is telling us around 400, 300, in that neighborhood AD, and the conventional history, which Arthur Wilson seeks to dispel, is 1300 AD, somewhere roughly around there, which is supposedly when Montauk Pharaoh came over. So, you know, there's a lot of room for speculation, but there's a thread of phonetics. That's really, you have a thread of phonetics combined with the legend, combined with the actual history. So we're finding to try and this trace elements. And I can only tell you, I recently have gotten the second chapter of the Montauk Project translated into the Spanish language. And I can't tell you how hard and resistant it was to get this book into the Spanish language. I mean, we were working on it. The man who was helping me actually had a very close brush with death. And it's the whole Spanish culture, the Hispanic culture, which we're talking about Latin America, is dominated by the Spanish language. This is the other end of the Spanish Armada, the part of the Spanish Armada that succeeded, and it basically conquered all of Latin America, the United States being the exception. So, you know, what this is like when we get into the study of magical languages and grimoire, or the grammar that Douglas Dietrich likes to talk about, call it grammar, you know, because it's the magical spells and incantations. Well, the Spanish language and the Catholic Church dominate the consciousness of Latin America. So to kind of get this book and to kind of like, you know, like it's like doing a spin on the whole culture to even get it into the language, which has not been easy. The same with the Italian language, because you have a restriction on certain types of books in Italy because of the Catholic presence there. You don't have your standard metaphysical bookshop in Italy. So I've been told by my Italian friends. I have not been to Italy myself in that regard to peruse the streets.
Well, let's take this all the way back then. Let's go ahead and jump back to the creation of Kabbalah. This relates to the Ark of the Covenant, Moses rising to the mountain, gathering stones, carving out the words of God, coming down the mountain. And according to Kabbalistic understanding, Moses made at least three trips to the mountaintop to then return glowing and forever veiled at this point, utilizing what seems to be the first weapon of mass destruction given to mankind, known as the Ark of the Covenant. So let's let the audience understand the roots of magic and how this pharaonic Hebrew connection then comes forward to this Montauk connection. What can you tell me about this, about Moses rising to the mountain and creating the Ark of the Covenant and how this falls into the story?
The first thing I want to say is, you know, these stories, and we have George Lucas to thank for it, for making it known, but these stories, and you'll even see cartoon versions of the Bible, they're really cartoons. Moses is a cartoon. The story of him is a cartoon. We are rendered, you know, this cartoonish version of history. And we can go to town on Moses, but in reference to the Kabbalah, what you have there, it's important, and you'll hear this in the lectures of Manly P. Hall, who is an interesting if not a dubious character in himself, but a lot of his scholarship is impeccable. He talks about this Holy of Holies which is where the Ark of the Covenant is really just an analogy to what's inside of your brain. You have a sacred space inside of your brain. So then what you have with the Ark of the Covenant is you have an externalization of the powers that are inside you. I mean, it's, you know, what this Ark of the Covenant can do or allegedly can do is an extension of what you could do as a human being if you had superpowers or were a fully developed human being. And of course, and then you have it turned into a weapon. Well, this is like Montauk Project, where you're turning into a weapon where you're taking, you know, let me just state this about the Kabbalah. And this was a decoding of the Book of the Law, which was done, you won't find it in the work of the standard OTO people, and this was helped to me by somebody who was kicked out of and attacked of the OTO. He helped me. I ran with some of it. I had my own stuff on it. But he helped me understand that if you look at, and it's all explained in the book, the Montauk Book of the Living, which is kind of an opus work that consolidates a lot of different themes that I've written. It's the last book I've written about the Montauk Project, because I went off into Romania after that and did a whole other series of work. But the Book of the Law shows the relationship between 5 and 6. And 5 and 6 is the relationship between the pentagram and the hexagram. 5 under 6, and this whole...
Just to be clear, I'm sorry, the Book of the Law that you're referring to is the one channeled by Aleister Crowley.
That's correct.
Okay, all right, just making sure.
Yeah, that's correct. And so you have the 6 over the 5, and I've given a demonstration in that book of how that forms the whole basis of the Kabbalah. But you also have reference in there to, you know, 5 and 6 equals 11. So that shows that 11 to be a... and when you twist it, it becomes a Mobius strip. So you have 11, 11 is the two DNA strands. So the Book of the Law is actually, if you look at the underpinnings of it and the secret message in it, the interpretation that is to come later, not by the OTO, but the interpretation is later. And I can't say I've interpreted it to the full extent of the law, but this is further, and I couldn't have done it without the help of this gentleman who calls himself Buddha, John Paroli. And he'd be an interesting interview. We could get him on there for you. You want to dig up all this stuff. But anyway, this is the basis of the Kabbalah, is this, and you'll see that the Kabbalah is based upon 5 over 6. You can show the schematic, but that's based upon DNA. So this is not the first time anybody said that the DNA corresponds to the Kabbalah. The people who write about it are ahead of the curve, but this is not the only time anybody said this. But there's a correspondence between the Kabbalah and the DNA. So what the Kabbalah really is, it is an interpretation of life. It is a schematic for life. When I showed a schematic of the Kabbalah to Preston Nichols one time, I was giving a lecture on it, on the Kabbalah, and he wanted to talk to me. So he sat through the lecture and listened to it. We had some hot and heavy thing going on we needed to talk about. So he listened to it, and he says, you know, that's just like the transmitter at Montauk. He says, that structure is just like the transmitter at Montauk. So... And what were they doing? They were manipulating life. So the Kabbalah is a schematic or a representation. It's a two-dimensional representation that can be three-dimensionalized with some cleverness and mathematics of DNA. So when somebody comes and puts these names on it, which they've all been codified by the Hebrews, it's like assigning name tags at a party. You know, to different people. Or if you want to do Kabbalistic parties and you have people dress up as the different characters and archetypes of the tarot, which is sometimes done, theatrical Kabbalah, you have people representing certain stations of life, which is not wholly inaccurate. But our whole Western society is based upon these Kabbalistic themes and archetypes, which are a mockery of the life process of DNA, which is constantly moving and flowing. This is why when you study the Kabbalah, you're moving and throw, you're moving and flowing into it and whatnot. So to go back to Moses, what you have is the idea of turning life, or God, in the case of this is the Ark of the Covenant between man and God, you're creating a weapon to mow people down. And that's exactly what happens. It's used as a weapon in this story. How much truth of it is, it's hard to say, but you know, it's a metaphor for what has happened in history. We have a lot of war, we have a lot of bad things, but the thing to remember about the Hebrew tradition is it all goes back to Abraham, splinters off into Christianity and Islam. They're all patriarchal traditions. And the matriarchal tradition of the Kabbalah, and you'll find it in the work of Kenneth Grant, which goes back to African Kabbalah. And what it is these are, the Kabbalah all reduces to emanations of the feminine, transmissions. You have transmissions and energies that are, we can call them, they call them murmurs or vaginal emanations, which is the emanations of creation. And then you get the patriarchs who come along and turn them into ultimately a weapon of mass destruction. So this is the paradigm we're living in. We're living in a paradigm of mass destruction. We have a lot of, and when people come on and do their singing and dances about Kabbalah, they're really going against a patriarch, they're employing a patriarchal tradition, which has its use. So, I mean, I talk a lot about the Kabbalah and the analogies in my recent work, and it makes sense with our society, but all of it is done under a huge, I guess, hidden, when you talk about occult, it's hidden energies that are underneath this, which are actually sustaining creation. And then you have all these people doing these weird manipulations with weapons, money, and all the stuff going on. So it's not a paradise. It's a deviation from paradise. So when the Moses analogy comes in, and there's other aspects to Moses that are interesting, kind of a side shoot, you know, I'm addressing your question in maybe a different way than you expected, but this is what I've found. End of communication.
Fantastic. Well, we find that many people that when they're subjected to this, the occult practices and even technological practices that lead to communication with interdimensional beings tend to fracture their mind. And it seems that these occult practices of communication with interdimensional beings has led to the MKUltra projects and to the ideas of trauma-based mind control.
Yeah, I agree with you. And it used to upset me. I can't say that it upset me. It disturbed me. I didn't lose any sleep over it. But I would see how these mind control victims would come out and talk about the Kabbalah being evil, and it being, you know, all witchery, and this is what the MK Ultra people use, because that's not really what the Kabbalah is. It's a pattern of life. But when you, vis-a-vis what you just said, there's a little bit of truth to it, because the dumping ground of life, which they call in the Kabbalah, you know, all those things that don't work or were considered, and what doesn't work in life could be called evil. So it's like it gets the turndown certificate from the morphogenetic grid, and it goes into the klifot or the kilipot. People pronounce it different ways. The klifotic energies, which is the anything that didn't happen in evolution, like the dodo bird, he failed, so he goes into the klipot, and he just kind of sits there. In other words, he's a memory, and all the things, the dinosaurs, all those things which were sort of shunted off, but they're there waiting to emerge. Maybe they'll emerge as evolution, but maybe they'll emerge as a monster from the so-called id of the morphogenetic grid. So you have these negative energies that, you know, will sometimes creep in to the psyche. And certainly, and people get opened up and whatnot, whether it's in any initiation of any tradition, is if you're not ready for it, other things will take you over. So this is a, you know, we talk about the trauma-based mind control that occurs in going back into history, and then you have people manipulating it when you go back into the cults of the assassins or hashishins of Hassan Saba, and you have the idea of people being able to manipulate people's minds, and that becomes a secret tradition which historically flows from the assassins to the Templars into the Freemasons of today, where there are certain things that are done in an unconscious basis, and certainly into the MK Ultra programs that we know too much of today.
Absolutely. You know, my father was a high-ranking Freemason, doing most of his work and even being raised to worshipful master in Bavaria and also working in Berlin quite often. Well, he ended up being on Killer Submarine, Killer One, with Jimmy Carter, the only president known to admit to seeing a UFO. And then my father went on to be a part of Project Blue Book, where mm-hmm. he was stationed on an island in the South Seas with four radar dishes tracking the incoming flying saucers. So this goes right to my own personal story as we start to get to the Montauk story in this connection between radar and extraterrestrials and these secret societies such as Freemasons. It all wraps up right there in my father, and yet I don't know enough to understand what he was into. So this has been kind of a personal quest for me to try and discover these secrets that might be hidden in my own past. So this now comes over to Montauk, and we have this connection, submarines, radar dishes, mind control, and secret societies, and it all culminates right there in Montauk. Let's just tell the audience a bit about how this occult works came over and what Montauk really is.
Well, you know, Montauk is a culmination of different projects, and it becomes with the study of radar invisibility that was occurring in 1943 with the Philadelphia experiment trying to make a ship invisible to radar, because there was a necessity for that during the war to make ships appear invisible to radar so that they wouldn't be sunk. This was a big problem of ships being sunk in the Atlantic by the Germans. So at the same time as that develops and people are subject to radio frequencies and microwaves, and they're devastated. So this became a whole study, what's called the human factor study, of why do people become discombobulated when they are subject to certain radio frequencies. So this is part of the history that occurs, and the sailors, some of the sailors are taken to Yaphank, Long Island, which is where, incidentally, we had the biggest conglomeration or gathering of Nazis outside of Germany was right at Yaphank, Long Island in the 30s. It was the Bund movement. And you had right next to that, you had the Philadelphia experiment survivors being studied in a locale that eventually becomes Brookhaven Laboratories. And it's you know, the premier lab on atomic research, the official lab. You had Los Alamos, but you had so many decisions taking place at Brookhaven. It was all about nuclear energy. And perhaps more importantly, microwaves. So this all grew out of the Philadelphia experiment. At the same time, you have MK Ultra formulating. And part of the MK Ultra experiments were based upon the research of post-traumatic stress syndrome that L. Ron Hubbard was privy to, because he worked in very classified areas of the U.S. Navy, especially the psychological operations. And then you had the research of the Germans, the captured German documents, and the work of Joseph Mengele. And to this day, Joseph Mengele is cited as, you know, some big heavy-duty mind control programmer who calls himself Dr. Green. I don't know if that's accurate or not, but many victims have cited Dr. Green, and not just one. And he was, but he did a lot of research on twins, on psychic research of twins, how to make them more psychic. And he was known to be a good scientist as far as genes and studying and understanding DNA and or genes, I should say, at that time. So when I say good scientist, it doesn't mean he was a moral or humane scientist, but he was an effective one. So you had all this work, and then you also had Nazi technology that they had combined with the Americans prior to the war, and some reports even indicate during the war. So you have all this culminating in the 50s and basically coming into full fruition in the 70s, where they could put the mind of a person and show it on a computer. They could show it on a, you know, I print it out. They could print out an idea. They could have a psychic, sensitively individual think of something, and they would amplify it through radio amplification and send it out into the environment and get people to react, get animals to react. We have evidence of this. It's not such a secret. This was very controversial at the time the book came out in 1992. It upset a lot of people. The truth upsets people. So, you know, the people's minds could be affected by such a outrageous proposition as the internal core of our government, or whatever you want to call it, perpetrating this stuff. Even recently, in the last weeks, we've had the CIA coming out and apologizing for the mistreatment of prisoners in the name of torture. And you have Dick Cheney coming out and saying, oh, we should have done it. I do it again, you know. So, yes, the government has dealt in abusive situations. The extent of it is been so much promulgated on the internet by stories of mind control, victims of mind control, some of them credible, some of them leaving you to scratch your head. But in all of this case, if you go into courtrooms and you case special victims, people, you have to give them their day to talk, and you have to allow them to talk, and you have to not deny them. If you look at some of the interviews that Michael Aquino, who's been accused of many instances of molestation and mind control and the like, you see him on Oprah. See, go, you can see this on YouTube, Michael Aquino and Oprah. He doesn't give the victim any chance of maybe his story's true. He's no sympathy for the victim. Instead, he's on the defensive and he's accusing the victim. Right. Making it up. And this is not the way you treat a special victim. Even if he's wrong, you have to allow the person his chance to, you know, recover from the traumatic incident, whatever happened to him.
Yeah, absolutely. That has been a huge part of this show here on FreemanTV.com is listening to these victims and allowing them to have their voice heard, and the communication of the fact that the only thing that really helps any of us suffer through this type of trauma is the acceptance and nurturing of others that will, you know, it's the only security is the really the only path to our salvation. Security with nurturing, that is, not through some sort of riot squads. You know, so it is, it's critically important. And this project in the Montauk Project started showing them some techniques and weaponizations of these psychic abilities. And now we have projects such as HARP and ISCAT and SURA, radio antenna transmitters that can broadcast in numerous frequencies. We have the idea that they are utilizing these technologies to send movies and commercials to distant stars, to the point that they sent a Doritos commercial to Ursa Major using the ISCAT antenna array in Sweden, and utilized the deep wave communications in Cape Canaveral to actually simulcast the movie The Day the Earth Stood Still to Alpha Centauri, so which they got to watch sometime around December 21st, 2012. I couldn't imagine being on Alpha Centauri that day.
Sad to think that they're so starved for such crummy entertainment, but...
Yeah. But this takes me to the idea of, as all these different connections of this technology to the occult, and you were talking about mind transfer and psychic transfer, communications through computers, and this has become mainstream science. This has become something that is openly researchable. You can look into the Blue Brain Project of Henry Markram and see as he tries to create a rat brain inside of a computer. And we start looking into these projects such as Blue Brain, Blue Beam, and Blue Book. And we, you know, where is all this blue coming into this picture when it's all connected to extraterrestrial communication?
Well, I don't know if you're asking me a question.
I know. That was kind of just like a, a rattle off in there because I had so many thoughts and ideas, and we're running out of time for this segment. And I was, I guess, trepidatious as to opening a whole new topic. But it seems that we have now reached a point where this Montauk radar project that was utilized to transmit thoughts into people's heads may have expanded into more global campaigns utilizing radio frequency antenna arrays such as HARP or SURA. And I wonder how, what we can deduce from the Montauk project to understand what they might be trying to attempt here, because the Montauk area seemed to be utilized for dark forces, maybe even the raising of an Antichrist and polarity research.
There's no question. There's no question that it resonates with the archetype of the Antichrist. But the HARP project is all an extrapolation and extension of what occurred at Montauk and Brookhaven Labs. You know, it's the more modern version, and its attempt to, because the early Montauk project dealt with weather control. It's weather control, it's mood control, and so you have a more highly sophisticated version in, you know, in Alaska. It's where we first learned of the HARP project. But Preston Nichols was dealing with antenna farms in Maine. I mean, he knew all about antenna farms, not talked too much about, but, you know, he actually would stumble into an antenna farm. It was right where he discovered the Wilhelm Reich materials up there in Rangeley, Maine. The secret buried Wilhelm Reich materials, which were a lot of what the Montauk research was based upon, putting people into trances and deeping into the deep archetypal parts of their memory, sort of similar to the stuff that Crowley used to dig up when he was going into some of his deep trances. But the so Montauk is a culmination of yes, secret stuff and an attempt to control and weaponize things, just as you were mentioning HARP. Douglas Dietrich gives some great insight into the HARP project as he was learning about it in his job there at the or in conjunction. I think the HARP project mostly developed afterwards. I think he might have learned some of this from Aquino. But anyway, of it, how it actually being a way to contain demonic energy, to trap demonic energy, to keep it in check. One thing Preston Nichols told me about the HARP project is that it's multi-layered and it does many things. You can't say it is just one thing. It's like trying to say that the U.S. government does one thing. The U.S. government does so many things, and it reaches into so many circles of influence, not all of them negative, that the HARP project is very much like that, because it's an attempt to govern the environment. That might include subduing demons. It might include changing the weather for better or for worse. It might include giving us a shield from the solar rays. I believe that's one of the things it does. It does protect our environment from going blippo with the heavy solar rays. So it's a multifaceted thing, and not all of these things are completely negative, even though they might be mostly negative.
Well, imagination and will, these are the two strongest points within the ideas of magic. And I thought we could end this first hour on those topics right there, because I know that you have utilized your imagination and will to manifest your soul's destiny, and I hope that your story can help others to try and find this purpose in life as you have found in these Montauk Chronicles. So let's just let's end this show with a little bit of help for the listeners and those in pick up on this transmission about the ideas of imagination and will and the positive aspects of how we can manipulate the morphogenic field.
Well, yes, it all begins with self-discovery. As you said in your own journey, it's about your own self-discovery. So, you know, people come up with all these incredible experiences and ideas and stories that they have, but not all of them are going to warrant going into a book format. You can put it up on a website, but the experiences are quite common. The experiences of abductions, weird stuff happening, it's so common. It's, the word is ubiquitous, means it happens all over the place. So the challenge is to recognize who you are, find who you are, where you're going, and create a sense of self-identification and self-determinism. Who are you? What do you want to do? I mean, this is almost like a success seminar. What are your goals? And, you know, go about finding your goals. Your goals might be to repair yourself if you've been damaged. Well, then make the goal that you're going to repair yourself, but actually accomplish it. Because some people you'll see, I've known people for 20 years in this field that are still repairing themselves and are still playing out, dramatizing the drama. You've got to be control. You've got to take control of the drama. That means taking control of one little thing. It might mean going out and getting a job. For many of them, that would be therapeutic. It might be controlling one aspect of your life. Controlling, you know, just one thing is how you start. And that's for people who are in need of remedy. But basically, all of this work that I have been done in the Montauk Indians led me to, you know, the supreme answer on the physical, spiritual, and mental level, which was the Montauk medicine man introduced me to his Qigong teacher, a Taoist priest by the name of Roosevelt Ganey, who works out of Brooklyn, New York. So this is all about breath, which is the mediator between mind, spirit, and body. So the answer is breath. If you can control your breath, you will control your life. And you've seen examples of yogis and whatnot of do it, or you've heard of them, but this goes into absolute empowerment of the individual. And there's different techniques. I've laid out some of them on the very beginning level in my new book, The White Bat, The Alchemy of Writing, which tells an incredible story of how I got involved in all of this. But it also gives the reader an opportunity not only to learn how to write his story, but to, if he wants to write his story, and to use writing as a therapy, but also to go into the realm of breath and into the realm of one's own psyche and soul to heal these things you're talking about. It's a self-regenerative process. And these things can be supplemented by a counselor if you're really in need of serious help.
Yeah, well, we are all in need of serious help. The world has gone crazy, and there are explanations, and they go to the bazaar. And Peter Moon, you are on the edge of the bazaar. I don't mean this in any bad way. I mean this in the most extraordinary way, that because what we're dealing with on planet Earth is so far beyond the simple political mechanizations, as we'll get into in the next hour, discussing deeper and deeper into these secret societies, the Nazis, and even taking this over to Transylvania and looking deeper into the situation going on there. But we are in a state where the world has gone mad, and no one can really see the true picture because so much of what has led to this is occulted. And I'm so glad that you are willing to come out here and share these experiences that you've gained through what seemed to be a synchronistic path. Is this correct?
Very much so. And synchronicity, according to Carl Jung, who coined the word, is the precursor to the Tao. And that's why it's really good if you can bypass all this stuff and go right to the Tao and not only read about it, but practice it. And I'm very fortunate that I've been given that opportunity, because I always had that thing clicking in my background. I studied the Tao Te Ching when I was in high school, and I've always, you know, kind of hung on to that. And now I got a chance to really practice it and learn from an active practitioner who learned from an Asian master. And I've been doing that for 7.5 years now.
Amazing. And again, if you go to the Tao of Physics, we find this ancient connection to our modern understanding of atomics. And it's a mind-blowing research, because when we start to understand how much they understood in the ancient past, that's when you really start to get the big questions as to how did they know all of this, and now how it's being used against us. So,
because it was nature, and now we're divorced from nature, and we're in a crisis because we deviated or distanced ourselves from nature, and we're sending out the opposite to Alpha Centauri and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the website is skybooksusa.com, where you can find all of Peter's books on the Montauk Project, on Transylvania, on numerous topics dealing with mind control, time travel. Trust me, Peter, we have much to talk about. I don't know if you know this, but we'll get into it in the second hour. But I did have the great pleasure of interviewing Dr. David Lewis Anderson before his disappearance into the ether, and I hope to get a little deeper into that with you in the next hour.
Sure.
And you also have another website people can go to.
Yes, it's digitalmontauk.com, and it's Digital Montauk, MONTAUK, just like it sounds. And there's a very interesting, you know, we talk about the Nazis in Tibet. I've got posted on there, they're on YouTube, some Russian videos that have been transcribed into English by my Romanian friends about the connection to early TV, which corroborates some of the things that Douglas Dietrich has said about early TV in the Nazi Empire. And this character Sahib, who was teaching Goebbels's children and Hess's, I think, aunt or nephew, Rudolf Hess's nephew. So it's a very interesting thing there on the Tibetan connection to Nazi Germany, and it's stuff that's never been seen in any conventional Nazi conspiracy literature, because it's come out of Russia and comes to me by way of Romania.
Amazing. I look forward to talking to you about that in the next hour. We'll get into some Nicholas Rorick and the Eye of the Pyramid and the Tibetan connections for all of this, and how the occult has influenced and created civilizations and technologies of today. So stay tuned, folks, for Peter Moon as we switch over to the members' side. And thank you all for tuning in here on FreemanTV.com. We will see you next week.